from an end-to-end perspective, we had a set of instruments that were on the lander deck for the lander that then got deployed down onto the ground, onto the surface of Mars. And I was responsible for figuring out how we were going to do that, the robotics, the sequences, the procedures, ultimately how we were going to test that, and then ultimately how we were going to execute that on Mars, and then a lot of problem solving along the way. So I know a lot about InSight. And so what I would also suggest is during my talk, if you have some questions, just raise your hand, get my attention and ask me some questions. Frankly, turning this kind of presentation into more of a discussion, frankly, is more interesting for you all. And it's also more fun for me as well. So don't be afraid to ask me some questions. So, okay, and then hopefully the charts are working. We'll see where this goes. Okay, so as you're probably well aware, there's been a number of missions to Mars from NASA. And you may or may not know that there's been a number of missions to Mars, both from NASA and then from other countries, that haven't gone quite so well. But we've been fortunate and perhaps even lucky that the missions from... What's that? This is true. This is true, but sometimes JPL stands for just plain lucky. So... there is an aspect of blessedness, as well as then sometimes we will take advantage of the luck that's available to us as well. The chart here I've got is, you know, some of the things we've learned about Mars we can see from space. And you can see things like dust devils, and you can kind of see some avalanches. And we've had a number of surface missions that have told us about the geology and the internal, you know, workings of the planet. But there's still a lot we don't know about the workings of Mars. And that's kind of what InSight was about. We wanted to learn things about, you know, are there earthquakes? You know, are there, you know, what is the core of the planet like? And that's what InSight was about, determining what is going on inside Mars. Okay. Okay, so just a couple of fun facts and a kind of a fun set of images. This image gives you a relative sense of the size of the Earth, which is roughly about 8,000 miles in diameter. Mars, roughly about 4,000 miles in diameter. And then the Moon, roughly about 2,000. And then, if you've got one Earth G here on Earth, the gravity on Mars is about one-third. So we would all weigh one-third of what we do here on Earth than what we would on Mars. And then for the Moon, it's about one-sixth. So just a couple of fun things. And then, like I said, you know, the questions that InSight was attempting to answer is working to answer is, are there things like Marsquake? Is there plate tectonics and things that would help us better understand what the Earth is doing? Can we learn some of that from Mars? And the answer is actually, you know, it's a rocky planet, bears some similarities to Earth, and it will help us to understand what's going on here as well. How big is its heart? That's, to some extent, these charts are written for a very broad audience, especially for at the school kid level. So it's talking about what's going on inside the planet and what kind of a core does the planet have, you know, certainly on the Earth. When we see lava coming out of, you know, volcanoes are in Hawaii, that's a representation of the molten core that the Earth has. Well, we're trying to figure out, does Mars have any moltenness? We kind of think no, but this will help us better understand that. Okay. And in fact, this is kind of a picture of this. The real simple questions in a sort of simplified language for what we're trying to do with InSight is measure the vital signs of the planet, kind of giving the planet a little bit of a kind of a checkup or what have you. We're looking for the pulse. Is it vibrating? Are there Mars quakes? That kind of stuff. Is it just any kind of, you know, vibration we would pick up on our seismometer? It's the temperature. What's the temperature of the planet? If, you know, even if you are here terrestrially and you go down in a mine, especially say the gold mines in South Africa that are like a mile and 2 miles deep, those mines are very, very warm. And it's the heat flow coming out of the planet that warms that. So we're trying to figure out how does that work on Mars. And then the reflexes, it has to do with kind of the wobbling and the oscillation of the planet. And so that's about that for that one. So this is a representation of the InSight lander. So it's a lander with legs. It's not a rover. Once we are down on the ground, we're not moving. We're at that spot. And in fact, we, for a couple of reasons, we have to disable the propulsion system. So despite the fact that we have leftover fuel and we have rocket engines, we're not taking off and moving anyplace. We're a solar-powered mission. We're actually doing really, really well with our solar power. We've got two big solar wings that are sticking out the side. And now let me take you through a few details. I'll touch base on a few things. One of our key instruments is something called HP cubed, or HP3 sometimes. This is the thing that measures the heat, the temperature of the planet. And basically, it's kind of a drill that will burrow down into the planet. And it has a tether, which has some temperature sensors. And that will measure more or less the ground temperature of the planet as the heat probe, or what we call the mole, burrows in. Moving around, let's see. We have a pair of radio antennas. Sometimes, and we use it kind of in a dual mode. We use these, what's called the RISE antenna. We also just use that for the radio link from Earth to the planet. We use that quite frequently, but we can also use it for radio science. Talk a little bit more about that. We have a UHF antenna, so another radio link that we have. We primarily use the UHF system as a radio link to the orbiters overhead. The UHF system gives us a lot more data link or a higher bandwidth. You know, imagine, you know, the difference between Ethernet at your house versus how much data you could transmit on an old telephone line. The UHF antenna and system gives us a lot more data volume. The RISE system is kind of more of an old school, you know, much lower data rate system. We have a pressure inlet, so right in the center of the lander, we have a system that can measure the barometric pressure of the planet. So what this leads into is we have a system, in addition to the three key instruments, we also have more or less a meteorology system on the lander, so we can measure the winds, we can measure the air temperature, we can measure the barometric pressure, and that gives us a sense of they're just kind of the weather that's going on there and the prevailing winds and things like that. And by the way, it gets quite cold on Mars. Nighttime temperatures are down around minus 90 C, you know, so much colder. Or for me, Buffalo. So, but for unlike Montana and Buffalo, it's not snowing there. Let's see. What else do we have? We have a robotic arm, and we'll talk about more about that in this a little bit, but we use the robotic arm to deploy the instruments to the surface of Mars. And we also use it to help take pictures of our landing site. The arm has a camera. It's called the instrument deployment camera. So if you imagine the robotic arm, we've got an upper arm and a forearm, and then the joint down on the lander deck is kind of the shoulder, and then we have an elbow, and we have a wrist at the end of the forearm. The camera is kind of mounted, you know, right near the elbow, and we use that to kind of look in detail at the places we're going to put the instruments. Yes, sir, I've got a question.
Jim, can you give us an idea of how wide it is? What's the size that we're looking at?
Yeah, good question. The question is, what's the relative size of the things that we're looking at? Let's see. And I'll probably first talk in metric and then switch it into units that some of us understand. The deck height, the height from the top of the deck down to the ground, is roughly 1 meter. So a meter is more or less a yard. So imagine that the deck height from here down to the ground, it's about 3 feet, 1 yard, 36 inches. The diameter of the solar arrays, those are, I want to say, roughly 2 meters in diameter. So those solar arrays are roughly, Evan's taller than me, so one Evan tall. So it's roughly this high. In the old days, when the ruler, the size of the ruler's foot set the length of a mile, I guess so. let's see, the links on the arm are roughly each about 1 meter in length. I think it's not quite because I think the full reach of the arm is 1.8 meters. So that's a little bit less than 6 feet. It's probably around 60 inches or so. Okay. Yes, ma'am, right here.
I noticed on the heat flow probe, you said it went in the ground. How far down does it actually go?
Well, we'll get to that in a little bit. But the intent, the design of it was such that it could go about 5 meters deep. So that's roughly speaking about 16 feet down into the ground. Yes, ma'am, back there. Oh, yeah. So, really good question. Why is InSight stationary versus a rover? And the kind of the really very basic answer is all of the investigations for InSight, you just have to be in one spot. You want to be, you know, stationary. Set up your instruments, and then we more or less just record data. For as long as we can record it. We've got I haven't gotten into it yet, but the key instrument, it's a seismometer. It measures Mars quakes. You just want to sit there and listen and record data. And the same thing with the heat probe, the same thing for the weather, the meteorology equipment that we have. It's just there to, it's basically, it's a data collection station. And we get our instruments set up, dialed in, and then pretty much just we record data. Versus if we were a rover, so the rover missions, I've worked on those too. Those are more, think of those to some extent as a roving field geologist, where they're going around, they have different tools to look at different rocks, sample different rocks, look at the chemistry. So think of the rovers really as a field geologist that has to get around all over the place. We're more or less just, we're a, in a very, very trivial sense, we're a weather station. We're recording data. So, okay. Let me finish up this chart. So, we talked about the robotic arm. On the end of the arm, we have something called an end effector. That's this grapple thing. That's the thing that we use actually to pick things up and put them on the ground. And if you've ever been to a penny arcade or a pinball kind of arcade, and you've seen those systems where you have the magic claw coming down and trying to grab the stuffed animal or something like that, we actually made one of those grapples that holds on to things rather than letting it fall away. So that's what the grapple's for. We have another camera. We have two cameras. One was on the arm. The other is just below the deck of the lander. And we use that to provide a broad overview of our workspace in front of us. And then lastly, this thing down in the lower left-hand corner, that's the SEIS instrument. SEIS stands partly for seismometer. And it's underneath this thing. It's called the wind and thermal shield. And the seismometer, the seismometer that we carry, is incredibly, incredibly sensitive. So it picks up just about anything that you can imagine would create a dynamic signal. And part of our job was to isolate this instrument from any noise content that was not a seismic signal. So we had to, you know, come up with ways to isolate the seismometer from wind and thermal variations. And that's what the wind and thermal shield does. Okay, let's keep rolling. All right, so this just kind of highlights the HB cubed. I'm probably not going to touch much more on that right now. This is a kind of a cute little graphic. The mole, the thing that's the thermal probe that drags the tether down with the thermal sensors, it's Ross will appreciate this. It's a hammer drill. Imagine a jackhammer, which is where you've got a motor inside the mole with a moving mass that then is released and, you know, really hits it with a lot of energy, and that drives the mole down into the ground. And that's all it's doing. So, okay.
So it doesn't displace the dirt, it's trying to pound a hole through.
Yeah, think of a self-hammering nail, and it's not scooping the dirt and moving it away. It has to displace it because the dirt has to flow around the mole. But it's that's just how it works. And it's almost like driving a nail into wood.
So. How did you know you could do that and you weren't going to hit like a piece of granite?
Yeah, more about that in a little bit. but the real answer is that when we were working with the geologist to help identify our landing sites, we had to look for places where frankly, would be hopefully benign for HB cubed, such that it wasn't filled with a lot of rock, and or we didn't land on a lot of bedrock where we were just just sitting on kind of flat rock like this that we would never be able to hammer into. So that was actually quite a challenge. But there are a lot of rocks in our area. Question here. Oh, this graphic?
Partly to give you some insight.
But yeah, where we landed, there's no edges. This is just a graphic, just to kind of illustrate the cross section of where HB cube's going down. Yeah, we would never want to land anywhere near this. Not that we could control it that well. So, okay, there was a question over here. Okay, let's keep going. Okay, so I mentioned the rise antennas. So we use part of our telecom system also for radio science. And what the scientists can do, especially the guys that really understand this, they can use the our radio antennas and just kind of almost regular everyday radio communication back and forth from Earth, one, to localize InSight's location very, very precisely on Mars. And then they can also use it to help measure the wobble of the planet, which is actually very important to giving some understanding of the interior dynamics of the planet. So the radio science is actually, a very important but kind of very subtle instrument that we carry on InSight. Next, these are our two cameras. So we really only do have two cameras. They're both color. The one that's mounted on the arm, when you see any kind of close-ups, it's coming from the arm-mounted camera. Then there's the instrument context camera. That's the one that's mounted to the underneath the lander deck. And it's much more of a fisheye kind of lens. So when you see the images of the ground, somewhat of sort of a distorted fisheye kind of lens, but a very broad field of view, it's coming from this one underneath the deck. Just a couple of kind of interesting things in the lead up to our launch. Let's see. Over on the left here, you can see some images of the building of the lander in one of the clean rooms back at Lockheed Martin in Denver. And Ross, this is where you can get a sense of some of the size of the things. There's more or less average size technicians putting the hardware together. You've got the lander deck right here, and then you've got the two solar arrays. So you can get a sense of how big this thing is. The lander itself was the lander and the crew stage and the aeroshell for EDL, entry, descent, landing. That was built in, this is a good point. That was built by Lockheed Martin in Denver. The seismometer was built and provided to the mission by CNES, the French Space Agency. And much of it was built in Paris, and then contributions from some of the other European nations. The HB cubed instrument was provided by the Germans, DLR, their space agency. And then some of the equipment, including the robotic arm and the cameras, that was provided by JPL. Okay. We launched out of Vandenberg, over west of Santa Barbara, on Cinco de Mayo last year. And I was probably the best launch I didn't get a chance to see. I was at the launch site, but as you can imagine, in Southern California, we had a very, very heavy marine layer. I was probably 2 miles away from the launch site. I heard it wonderfully, set off car alarms, never saw anything. It was just the fog was just, thick as pea soup, as they might say. We had our cruise, and then we approached Mars. We landed Cyber Monday, the Monday after Thanksgiving. And that's when we, have our, if you call it the six minutes of terror. And then we've been in surface operations ever since. So we've been on the ground, I think now for roughly 4 months. We've started to move very aggressively into our science gathering mode. And it's been going great so far. Let's see. Yeah, the requirement, if you will, is that we need to have a one Mars year lifetime after we complete the deployments of the instruments. So we completed the instrument deployments, let's say roughly the end of February, So we're now into our lifetime. So it should last, well, by requirement, it should last for, if you remember that, if you don't know, but one Mars year is roughly 2 Earth years. So we're going to be on the ground, hopefully operating for at least 2 years, and presumably more than that, because there's very few things that are going to be life-limiting on this mission. So the biggest thing is how much dust will accumulate on our solar rays. If we get too much dust on the solar rays and we don't have any cleaning events, meaning kind of a little bit of a windstorm or a dust devil, then at some point we may just run out of power, and then we just can't maintain thermal stability overnight. So, okay, keeping rolling. These are just some pictures of the assembly. It's kind of neat. We carried a microchip that people were able to send their names in, and then they added their signatures onto this microchip. And it's one of the kind of the fun things that NASA and JPL try to do to include, reach out to the public and include their, get their participation on the mission. I've been fortunate. My kids have had the opportunity to sign some of the hardware that we've sent to Mars, and, you know, brought them into the clean rooms and getting stuff signed. So that's always been kind of fun. Let's see. This is just a picture. You guys might have actually had a better chance of viewing the InSight launch than we did in Santa Barbara, in Lompoc. It was the pictures that I've seen from people that, you know, at Mount Wilson and, you know, some of the coastal range in Santa Barbara look fantastic. We didn't see anything. We just heard it. Kind of an interesting little side note. We had, if you will, kind of two hitchhikers on our launch. We had two CubeSats launch with us. They were called Marco. And they followed InSight all the way to Mars. And what they were is that they were kind of a radio relay for us. It's very important for us when we land at Mars that we have enough telecom and telemetry such that if anything goes wrong, we can kind of reconstruct the mission. And we had these Marco CubeSats, and they really are no bigger than a suitcase, but they're a fully functional spacecraft. And they served as a relay for us to, we were getting telemetry out of the lander, and Marco picked this up and then after landing, retransmitted it. And it was another way for us to get, kind of ensure that we had good telemetry from the vehicle during landing day. So kind of cool thing. What's that? They were built. Both of them were built and tested at JPL. And seriously, they were really no bigger than the size of a suitcase, and I think they weighed all of about 10 kilograms apiece. So it's roughly about 22 pounds. Question over there in the corner. Probably. what would be amazing is if he could actually get away with that, because we go through such a rigorous and strenuous test program that it's geared such that would be no surprises whatsoever. So for a surprise like that to sneak through would be almost unthinkable. Yeah. Let's keep rolling. Cool thing that Marco did is this is kind of a selfie. So they turned one of the Marcos around, and it actually got a picture of the combination of Earth and the Moon. And you can see the solar array for Marco over here on the right-hand side. So it's kind of a nice little cool byproduct of that. And the benefit was for Marco is that they were somewhat of a technology demonstration thing that JPL provided that is probably, likely kind of groundbreaking in terms of what we'll be able to do in space. I think you'll start to hear more and more about CubeSats and these kind of things going forward. This is just kind of a roadmap of the locations where InSight landed versus all the other landers that we have on Mars. And it turns out InSight, for not necessarily intentionally, we landed actually quite close to the Curiosity rover. We're about 350 kilometers or so away from Curiosity. Not that Curiosity would ever be able to drive over there. But really, the reason why we InSight landed there is from a scientific perspective, and for earthquakes and that sort of stuff, as well as then landing safety, we frankly were looking for one of the most, if you will, boring, flattest, non-rocks filled sites that we could find on Mars. And this is the location that was it. And it was, if you've seen our landing site, and I've got a few pictures of that coming up, we landed at a wonderful landing site. There was no rocks, and you know, significant rocks where I needed to place the instruments. Very broad, flat. The winds are not particularly high. It's been absolutely fantastic, and to some extent, the soil was pretty good for HP Cube. So this is roughly what we're supposed to look like on the ground, and to some extent, this is what we look like. It took us about 90 days or so to complete all of our deployments rather than 30 days. And we're actually pretty well into the science gathering mode for the mission. I think the next chart to set this up was when we got this down on December 18th was both for me a personal incredible relief, because it's the first image we got back after we had deployed SICE. And then it was just a remarkable, we finally have deployed this instrument that we've been working on since 2011. And that was this. As you can imagine, this is the instrument that the French have provided to us, that we had said, all right, we're going to get this deployed. And my job from that point through here was to figure out how to get this done, and getting this image back. And there's a lot of things that either we need to be blessed or we need to be lucky, had to work right to get to this point. And that was this. And this is where, the orange thing down here at the bottom, that's the seismometer. It's actually inside the orange thing. The orange thing is actually kind of a thermal structure that helps keep the seismometer warm, but that was inside there. And then you can start to see that there really is a pretty flat and smooth workspace for us to around. So that was December 18th. We spent the better part of about a month and a half after this getting the instrument set up. And then after we had the instrument set up, we had a number of things we had to do. We did this, which was to deploy the wind and thermal shield over it as well. We also got better with taking pictures and creating a pseudo video. This thing is the wind and thermal shield. The first half of this, where it's down on the ground, that was something that we did in one day, really over the course of about 5 minutes. But then if you notice, it takes a little while for the skirt to finish deploying. That was a little bit of a nervous point on my part, because it's, at least initially, it was kind of stuck, and we had to be a little bit patient, hoping that the kind of the compaction on that skirt would relax over time and that it would complete its deployment. Fortunately, it did. And then one of the key things that this thing had to do was shield the seismometer from the wind. And almost immediately, the scientists are saying, look, here's the data from, as we were first deployed, here it is with WTS on it, and there's no wind. And they're absolutely ecstatic, and they were really very, very pleased with the performance of the instrument, of the seismometer at that point. Okay. Let's see, we get as cold as about minus 90 C at night, but the seismometer itself, I think gets about as low as about minus 50 or minus 60, off the top of my head. This is the last, I think the last picture I have. This one shows you the picture from the camera that's mounted underneath the lander deck. You can see SICE and WTS right here. This is HP Cubed right after we deployed it. And these things here stretching back to the lander, Each of the instruments have a tether. That's how we communicate with the instruments and get the data off of the instrument and back onto the spacecraft such that we can radio it back. And then some of the stuff down in the lower right-hand corner, these are the legs for the lander and what have you. I mentioned about HP cubed and rocks. So we've released the mole, the thermal probe with the hammer drill. We've been pounding into it, but we think the mole may have hit a rock. So we're working through how do we get the mole unstuck such that the mole can continue burrowing down, to the full depth. But that's currently our biggest challenge right now, is getting that unstuck, if you will, and getting it set up such that we're getting good science from the mole as well. Question over here.
So, Jeff, what kind of material is that tip on that mole?
I don't know off the top of my head. I didn't work too much on the mole. My guess is it's probably a hardened steel. Okay. But then it hits a rock. It's got a pointy tip. It's in the ground. There's a lot of forces the mole itself has a lot of force to move forward, but there's a lot of forces to overcome to get it to keep moving forward too. Question right here. Yeah, we do. And in fact, that's a good reminder. I think when we deployed WTS, I think the air temperature was around minus 50 degrees C. And then over the course of the day, especially in the afternoon, we can get up around 0 degrees C. So right around the freezing temperature for us. And that's one of the warming of the air temperature. Helps the skirt to deploy. In fact, then if you're interested, if you can find our public website where you can find all of these images. And then I think recently, also on the InSight NASA public website, they've added a page where you can get not a weather forecast, but a weather report. You can see what the winds are and temperature and barometric pressure and that kind of stuff. So it's actually kind of cool. That was a neat feature that I saw they put up about a month or so ago. So. Ross first.
Jeff, before you finish, could you just make a statement about how you relate what you do and what we're seeing to your faith?
Sure. So there's a number of ways for me to answer that question. And I'll start with this one. So as an engineer, we go through a lot of, training in school about physics and all that kind of stuff. And when you're doing your homeworks and that kind of stuff, it seems kind of, okay, F equals MA, Newton's law, that kind of stuff. Okay, yeah, it's easy for us to write that down and believe it. But when you have to, the success of the thing that you're relying upon, relies upon all of those different laws of physics and the engineering, it actually, in my opinion, requires a very high level of faith, not exactly the faith that you're talking about, a very high level of faith that those physical laws that you think you learned and maybe tested are actually true. I mean, when we're getting ready to land on Mars and we're going to rely on a heat shield and a parachute, you actually got to have a lot of faith that all of that stuff works and you did it right. So that's one answer. Another way for me to answer that is I work with a lot of people and I lead a number of teams. And for those of you that have to work with a lot of people, even maybe not so many people, there's a lot of different personality types and what have you. And I've kind of learned, through my faith, to value each of my team members and to make sure that we're maximizing all of the different contributions. There's probably thousands of people that have contributed to InSight. And it requires, for me at least, a lot of skills to make sure that it we can all work together and all contribute properly. So those are a couple answers. So, right here. Yeah, so the one-way light time, so the the time that it takes a the radio signal is, it's about, depending upon the year and the relative position of the Earth to Mars, it's about 8 minutes or so. So that means that the round trip light time is about, roughly speaking, 16 minutes, right? And so it's unlike, you know, other robotics missions here terrestrially, we can't joystick everything. We don't really just have a controller sitting in the back of our operations room and say, all right, you know, let's bring the arm over here and do this. We have to actually be very careful about setting up those sequences, get it to do something very deterministic, and then looking at the results and deciding what to do next. So, in the back first. I don't know for certain. I know we have good relations with SpaceX. SpaceX and, you know, other commercial ventures, you know, they've, among other things, have provided launch services. I worked on an instrument that was launched on a SpaceX launch back about a year or so ago. And JPL is, you know, kind of always looking for different partnerships. So probably the almost the default answer is yes, but I don't know if anything specific. So, right here.
What programming language was the InSight lander programming?
Good question. I'm a mechanical guy. They try and keep me away from the software. I think much of it was done, I think, in VML, virtual machine language, which is how we wrote the different sequences and that sort of stuff. But I also suspect that there's a variety of other languages used for, you know, the different local code and, say, the cameras and what have you as well.
Java.
Yeah, I don't think we were using too much Java. On board the lander, probably not, but I think a lot of it was VML. Oh, man. Hey, man. How you doing?
Probably hoping for the best, I would think, but what do you expect, Jeff, will be the longevity of this project or this lander?
You know, in the best sense, this thing, I think that the lander could last many, many years. And it all comes down to, now that we've got our instruments deployed, for the most part, we don't have to move anything around anymore. So it's going to come down, the longevity is mostly going to come down to power and energy generation. So that comes down to how much dust do we accumulate on the solar rays, and do we get any cleaning events to remove that? And if you think back, we just concluded the mission with the Opportunity rover after about 15 years,
yeah.
And it was because we had a major dust storm over the past year or so that finally, you know, led to the, you know, point where it wasn't generating enough power and filling the batteries, which was then just like then that's what caused Opportunity to die. We're probably going to be in sort of the same situation with InSight. That it could go on for a very, very long time. That would be wonderful. The design life was one Mars year. The other thing that could kill us is thermal cycling. It gets very hot, very cold, and is there some long-term thermal fatigue stuff that would break solder joints or something like that?
She took that into account, no doubt. But it seems like the main enemies are the wind and the dust and the temperature, right? Did you take in precautions for those factors?
Yes. From a dust perspective, we really oversized the solar rays such that we could generate a lot of power, such that we could, you know, fill the battery and basically, you know, trying to kill that problem with margin. For the winds, and, you know, we basically designed to a set of winds, although, you know, if we get a very strong dust devil that flies right over us, we may not be able to survive that. That's, you know, because you're looking at winds, even at a very low pressure, that would create a significant dynamic pressure on the vehicle that could, you know, could cause some damage.
And real quick, just one last question.
Sure.
Are there specific regions of the planet that are more windy than the other regions? I would imagine up north, that, you know, the climate's much different.
You know, I don't know if I can comment on. In general, it's a the planet's pretty windy, although the winds are pretty repeatable from a day-to-day kind of perspective. But I don't know if there are more or greater winds in one place or another. It's
yeah,
just
you don't
not
have weather satellites.
yeah, and it's just I just don't know that part of the climate very well.
Okay,
so,
thank you.
Mark. Well, it's not particularly sticky, although it can, you know, adhere just due to static electricity. But one of when I refer to cleaning events, one of the things that we've found is that every once in a while on both the Opportunity and Spirit rovers, we would get a cleaning event, which was essentially, you know, we'd get a big gust of wind or a dust devil passing over us, and then all of a sudden it would blow off a lot of the dust, and our power levels would come back up. So. But we do find we are finding a lot of dust. If you look at the pictures from right after we landed till now, you already see like, wow, there's definitely a lot of dust there. So, okay. So, anyways, oh, another question.
What useful data are you getting from this?
Well, so I'm an engineer. And my useful data was the pictures that showed all of the deployments were done and everything was on the ground, and my job was done. I was very happy. But then on the seismometer, I know that the seismologists are ecstatic about the performance of the instrument. To my knowledge, they have not seen a Mars quake yet, although they're hoping that that will come soon. I think that they have... I've heard them use some terms that imply to me that they are seeing some vibrations of the planet, but not necessarily a Mars quake. They also, with some of the Martian moons, they can see a gravitational tide, or essentially when the moon passes overhead, they can sense that the change in gravitational attraction. So they're able to see that and help calibrate themselves. With HP cubed, it's not fully in the ground yet, so they're not getting temperature data. We are getting a lot of wind and temperature and pressure data, so that's actually been fantastic in terms of just helping us to better characterize the planet and improve our models for winds and what have you. So what we're getting right now. And then I don't know if you saw it, but it was kind of cool too. There was a... On three consecutive sols, a sol is a day on Mars, there was a solar eclipse. One of the Martian moons, I think it was Phobos, but it could be the other one, passed in front of the sun, and we could actually see the dip in the illumination. We actually caught the drop in the sunlight during that thing. So it was kind of a cool gee whiz kind of thing too. So right here. No, we don't have a good way of retracting it. Yeah, that's what we said. So it's got a, it's assuming it's just kind of a rock of sort of a finite size, it should be able to kind of deflect around, but we got to make sure that we set it up properly to get it, allow it to do that.
Will it break off?
What's that? Break off the rock or break off the mole?
The mole.
No, the tether behind it is pretty flexible and pretty tough, so I don't think it's going to break off that one.
Is the dust on the moon similar to the dust on Mars?
You know, I don't know. I don't know if we would consider it similar. I think it would. It has a different chemistry. I think there's a lot of iron oxide in the dust at Mars, hence the reddish color, and you don't quite see that on the moon because it's generally more of a gray color. So, okay. All right. So back to you.
Great.
All right.
Let's give Jeff a hand.
There you go.
Thank you.
You're up.
Was that cool or what?
Yeah.
Thank you, Jeff. right here in our own backyard. I love that. All right. Our guest speaker this morning is me. And here we go. So, I noticed that. So, this is a question that I've been asking myself and sort of pondering for 2 or 3 years, and I thought, it's time to do a talk, okay? Which Old Testament laws still apply to Christians? And from an apologetic standpoint, somebody might come up to you and ask,
Ross, in the Bible, there's a lot of old laws, like don't wear clothing of mixed materials. And nobody seems to follow that. But you Christians seem so hung up on homosexuality as a sin. It seems like you guys are just picking and choosing the laws you want to follow.
How do we answer it? Let's start. If you guys have an idea, let's hear it. Dan?
Moses gave us the law, Old Testament, and New Testament, Jesus gave us mercy and truth. That's it.
Okay. Big Jim?
That law was specifically only for the Jews.
Okay.
And it made them think every day when they get up, they got to decide, what am I going to wear today? And they say, well, I can't go with this, with wool, with cotton, or linen they have over there. And that reminds me to think that that's how God created things. He separated this thing. He put things in different compartments, in different definitions. So every day they have to think about that God made them.
Very good. Okay. Thank you. Lee?
First of all, you have to consider the purpose of the law. For example, not to eat certain type of meats. Since that came out, we found ways of curing it, and the problem with eating that meat no longer exists. Like laws today, for instance, it just says you have to have a certain buggy whip. We don't have buggies anymore. So these are things you have to consider, not that you discount it, but the purpose it was there. And there's usually, God has pretty good reasons for telling you not to or to do something.
Okay, very good.
Also, they had no refrigeration, right. And the processing levels that we have now are better. Sure. Even without refrigeration.
See, but if I were a skeptic, I might say, but this is a command from God. It's not up to you to interpret it or say, it no longer applies. Who are we to do that? Now, I'm just taking the other side here, okay? John?
Well, the Old Testament laws were given as a requirement for a covenant with Israel. And they numbered about 600. Then in the first century, when God appeared in the form of a man, he said that there were basically two commandments, that is, love God with all your being and to love your neighbor as yourself. And then the inspired writings of the apostles stated clearly that any sexual intimacy outside of marriage is strictly forbidden, that it's a disgrace and it's against God's will, and it logically you need to understand that It is very destructive or detrimental to strong families, which make a strong society. And that's the reason that those restrictions were included with the New Testament writings.
Okay, good. Thank you. I'm going to keep going here. Well, go ahead.
Well, I agree with all that, but I get asked this question a lot. You know?
Okay.
And I think basically there's three types of laws. There's the civil, the moral, and the ceremonial. And Jesus added some to, or he abolished some things from the law in the sense that, you know, he spoke about divorce, and it was because of the hardness of the heart. But basically, I think Jesus fulfilled both the ceremonial and the civil. And
okay.
The civil was given to the Jews, so yeah.
So your answer to this question would be that the moral laws still apply.
Yes, absolutely.
But the ceremony and the civil laws don't.
Yeah, and clothing's not really a moral law. Or is it, Tim?
Or is it? Or is it? Okay. Let's do this. Oh boy. All right, I'm gonna. Okay, here's the goals of this talk this morning. First thing we're gonna do, and I can see right now that we're not gonna finish it today. Hugh will be back next week, and then I'm up again the week after. So in 2 weeks, we'll finish this. We're going to answer the question from our recurring critic.
Are Christians...
That's right. Are Christians hypocritical in which laws they pay attention to and which we don't? I'm going to answer the bigger question of which laws still apply to us today, explain why these questions are important, and in case you're falling asleep, okay, I am going to give you an entirely new and simple framework for thinking about your faith that will change your life with Christ forever. How's that for a claim? May have to wait 2 weeks, but that's where we're going. Okay, I have here 4 copies, because it's like 40 pages each. These are all 613 of the Old Testament laws that the Jews used to pay attention to. Have you ever seen it? Anybody seen it in one place before? It's pretty cool. Now, I couldn't use the church copier to make 50 copies of a 40-page document, okay? So what I'm gonna do is pass these around. And I don't really care if it gets broken up, if you take a couple of pages, it doesn't matter to me. What I want you to do is just look at them. Look at them all together, look at a few, however you want to. You keep them together, separate them up, I don't care what you do. Tim, could you give me a hand with this?
Is there an easy way for you to post that somewhere?
Well, here's the source. Okay, so if you want to go online, I got it from a Jewish website. And it's not on there, so I thought I'd put it on the screen. And it will be available. We'll download the PowerPoint to the website so you guys can check it out. If you actually want to see the list, you probably need to go to this website, okay? Now, we do not now recognize many of these Old Testament laws as binding, okay? Take a look at some of them. Which ones still apply? Which don't? And does the Bible give us a clear guideline on which ones still apply and which don't? And I want to say emphatically yes, and that's where we're going to go with this, okay? But you may not expect the answer that I'm going to give you. Like Doug said, I must have consulted him. There are 3 kinds of laws in the Old Testament. Civil describes behavior, crimes, kind of like stopping at a stop sign kind of laws. Ceremonial laws, what was clean and unclean, what you could touch, what you couldn't, sacrifices, temple practices, etc. And then there were the moral laws, like the Ten Commandments. Now, what's really important to know is the Bible does not make these distinctions. We made these distinctions, we made this up, and a lot of them actually overlap. So this is a nice, neat way of categorizing it, and it's easy to say the civil and ceremonial don't apply anymore and the moral do, but you read some of the civil and ceremonial and there's some moral aspects in there. And how do we know it's not, you know, in God's mind that maybe it's a moral issue that we don't put 2 different kinds of cloth in 1 garment? Who are we to make that distinction? Okay, so here's what I'm going to do for the first part of the talk. I'm just going to ask a lot of questions, and hopefully, however you've been thinking about this, I can shake it loose a little bit. Okay, and we will have an answer. Here's what the Bible says is the purpose of the Old Testament law. Okay, I'm not going to read these passages. You can take a picture of that or look it up online if you want. Number one, to reveal God's character. Who is he? What's he like? What's his personality? Number two, to set apart the nation of Israel. Some people say that the food laws, for example, they didn't eat pork. And one of the ways we can tell when we do an archaeological dig is we can tell if it was a Jewish campfire or a Gentile campfire because there's pig bones in one and not in the other. And sometimes the line is very, very clear. Okay? God wanted the Jews to look and behave differently. And the food laws were part of that. Number three, to reveal man's sin. How do we know what a sin is unless we have a set of guidelines that shape it out for us? Number three, to provide a way of worship. Sorry, that's number four. Number five, to provide God's direction. Israel needed kind of to know where they were headed. Where are we going? Number six, to provide forgiveness through sacrifices and offerings. The law is really clear that sin exists, that people mess up, that every day, that every minute, we need to come before God and ask for forgiveness. And the sacrifices, which in the future, as Christians, we believe pointed the way towards Christ, gave the Jews a way of doing that. Number seven, ultimately, of course, and those are all New Testament references there to show the need for Jesus Christ. Okay? So, we're still asked the question, which Old Testament laws are still binding on us? Let's look at this. This is Jesus speaking, okay? Matthew 5, starting with verse 17. Do not think that I have come to abolish the law or the prophets. I have not come to abolish them, but to fulfill them. For truly I tell you, until heaven and earth disappear, not the smallest letter, not the least stroke of a pen, will by any means disappear from the law until everything is accomplished. Therefore, anyone who sets aside one of the least of these commands and teaches others accordingly will be called least in the kingdom of heaven. But whoever practices and teaches these commands will be called great in the kingdom of heaven. For I tell you that unless your righteousness surpasses that of the Pharisees and the teachers of the law, you will certainly not enter the kingdom of heaven. Now, in doing the research for this, I came upon a YouTube video last week of a guy who is a Christian who follows all the law, tries as best he can to follow all the laws, all 613 laws. He says, well, there's no temple, so I can't do that. But as far as he said, he looks at this passage and he says, this is pretty clear. Is it? Should we still be following all 613 of the what now the Orthodox Jews try to follow?
No.
Okay. Where does the Bible say in the Old Testament anything about the Holy Spirit leading? Once again, I'm just going to come up against anything you guys say, okay? John?
We fulfill all the laws by accepting and believing and relying and trusting upon the life that Jesus led that demonstrated the perfection.
Good. That's kind of where we're going. That's right. All right, let's look. Okay, let's start with the food laws. I didn't put these verses up. You're just going to have to take my word for it. In Mark 7:15 and Colossians 2:16, the New Testament talks about how nothing that we put inside of us defiles us. Nothing that we eat defiles us. So in my mind, that eliminates the food laws. They no longer, anything we eat, now there's nothing in there about Big Macs and Krispy Kreme donuts and, you know, maybe some of those laws need to come back given the diet that we have. But there's nothing that we put in our stomach that spiritually defiles us anymore. Okay?
Not even cannibalism?
No.
If we take what the New Testament says, I would say that that might It could be a sin, but in and of itself, it doesn't defile us like the food laws, like the Old Testament food laws would have. That's a great question. Yeah. Mark?
What about the sacrificed blood? I think there's something about don't imbibe that.
Yes, there is. Yeah. There's a couple. Okay. We don't have to be circumcised anymore, us men, to be a Christian. That's pretty clear from the New Testament, Galatians 5, 6. Okay, so the laws regarding circumcision are out. Ceremonial laws, I would argue, don't apply anymore because Jesus Christ became the sacrifice for our sin, didn't he? So that whole system of looking forward to Jesus and atoning for our sins through sacrifice is no longer there.
He paid it all.
That's right. Civil law, you know, stop signs, that kind of thing. It only ever applied to Israel in the first place. We don't live there. And we don't live there 3,000 years ago. Okay? So that leaves the moral law. Now, what about the moral law, the Ten Commandments? Where I'm going to go here may surprise you. I hope so. So let's go. Start with Romans 6, 14. Sin is no longer your master, for you no longer live under the requirements of the law. Instead, you live under the freedom of God's grace. I don't see a footnote there that says, except for the moral laws. What's it say?
We don't, requirements
no requirements of the law. Does that include the civil, ceremonial? Does it include the moral law? Seems to be what it says, doesn't it?
Yep.
Yep.
It
says instead.
Okay, so let's see if this is just an isolated verse. Luke 16, 16, until John the Baptist, the law of Moses and the messages of the prophets were your guides. But now the good news of the kingdom of God is preached and everyone is eager to get in. Until John the Baptist. That's a pretty clear line, isn't it? Okay. Maybe it's just two isolated verses. Galatians 5, 18, but when you are directed by the Spirit, you are not under obligation to the law of Moses. How clear is this?
Very clear.
Okay, these are fun. Instead of just including three, I've got six or seven or eight here. Let's really look at them because I want you to see this is not just a little tiny piece of doctrine, okay? Galatians 3:21, is there a conflict then between God's law and God's promises? Absolutely not. If the law could give us new life, we could be made right with God by obeying it. But the scriptures declare that we are all prisoners of sin, so we receive God's promise of freedom only by believing in Jesus Christ. Having fun yet? Romans 7:4, so my dear brothers and sisters, this is the point. You died to the power of the law when you died with Christ. And now you are united with the one who was raised from the dead. As a result, we can produce a harvest of good deeds for God. When we were controlled by our old nature, sinful desires were at work within us, and the law aroused these evil desires that produced a harvest of sinful deeds, resulting in death. What he's saying there is we're so rebellious that once we know something's wrong, we do it just because it's wrong. But now we have been released from the law, for we died to it and are no longer captive to its power. Now we can serve God, not in the old way of obeying the letter of the law, but in the new way of living in the Spirit. Wow, what a powerful passage. Marlene?
So, I mean, I understand that there's no salvation for the law.
Right.
But that doesn't mean it's not a good idea.
Well, a good idea is different than a command.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But still, I mean, I'm your father.
Yeah. We
still meant to observe that without looking for salvation.
Yes, there is now... no longer salvation through the law. There really never was, because Abraham's faith was counted to him. It's just that we see it differently now. Steve?
I think we get the idea of release from the law confused. Sure Matter Jail is just down the street, and when we're released from that jail, the city and the good people don't disappear who voted that law. It still continues. But we're released from the power of the law of condemnation, as Romans 8, 1 and 2 say. Yeah. So there's a whole plethora of verses, I'll just give one, that give a different idea. For instance, in Romans 2, 13, it says, "For not the hearers of the law are just before God, but the doers of the law are justified." That's a powerful word. And it says, you Jews, you're not as good as the Gentiles who without the law have the law written on their hearts and are actually doing the law. You who have the law are not doing the law, and you are condemned, you're not justified. So the law has to do with justification here. We have to answer what part of the law is justification and what is not. In James, it says they were justified by the law. Rahab was justified. Powerful words. Let's deal with it.
Good. Between you and Doug and John, I think you've taught my lesson, so that's okay. Go ahead.
Set free. Mm-hmm. That's the way I look at it. We're set free from the shackles of sin. So, you know, you're living by the Spirit.
Well, I think there's freedom from having to obey 613 commands.
Yeah.
Okay.
That doesn't mean we can just go out and kill people.
Val?
We're still sinners.
We are still sinners. I'm still a sinner. I'm going to make it very personal. Okay.
Yeah, a couple of verses earlier, Paul changed law to guide in your translation up there, which means that you can answer the question, okay, what does it look like? It's a matter of what you're doing it for.
Mm-hmm.
You either have to do it or you die, or you do it in Christ and you can see you're doing it by what it looks like.
Good. Thank you. Okay, let's do a couple of more verses. This is a two-slider, so I'm going to read it. If Hebrews 8:7, if the first covenant had been faultless, there would have been no need for a second covenant to replace it. But when God found fault with the people, he said, "The day is coming, says the Lord, when I will make a new covenant with the people of Israel and Judah. This covenant will not be like the one I made with their ancestors when I took them by the hand and led them out of the land of Egypt. They did not remain faithful to my covenant, so I turned my back on them, says the Lord. But this is the new covenant I will make with the people of Israel on that day, says the Lord. I will put my laws in their minds, and I will write them on their hearts. I will be their God, and they will be my people. And they will not need to teach their neighbors, nor will they need to teach their relatives, saying, 'You should know the Lord.' For everyone from the least to the greatest will know me already. And I will forgive their wickedness, and I will never again remember their sins." When God speaks of a new covenant, it means he has made the first one obsolete. It is now out of date and will soon disappear. Wow. I love it. So powerful. Other passages regarding the law. I could have done these as well, but if you want more that basically say a similar thing, there's more. So I'm trying to show you that it's not just a few isolated verses. This is a main thrust of the New Testament, that we no longer live under any of the Mosaic law. Okay? Now, we're back to Matthew 5 and what Jesus said about fulfilling. He did not come to abolish the law, but to fulfill it. So in light of all those other verses, and in light of this, how do we integrate this? How do we put these together in such a way that we can come away and say this makes sense and one doesn't contradict the other? Let's start by coming up with a definition of the word fulfill. Jesus says he comes to fulfill the law. What does fulfill mean? Here's some dictionary definitions. To confirm. Yes, he confirmed that the law exists and is still in effect. To implement. Oh, there's something about doing. To make actual what was previously spoken. What was the purpose of the law? The final purpose was to tell us about Christ. To tell us about sin. So I want to focus on that third definition, to make actual what was previously spoken. Jesus Christ is the fulfillment of the law. Now I want to say that, go back, I missed one note here, but I want to say it. The irony is that the laws, Israel's laws, weren't even given to us. They were given to Israel. To a nation 3,000 years ago on another planet, another continent, in an, I'm thinking about Mars, in another culture. They don't apply to us as Christians. It's like asking what old ancient Roman laws still apply to us. We've never been under ancient Rome. I don't think there's any Orthodox Jews in the house, so they don't apply to us. They never did. Okay. Galatians 3:24. Paul is saying, let me put it another way. The law was our guardian until Christ came. It protected us until we could be made right with God through faith. And now that the way of faith has come, we no longer need the law as our guardian. Okay? Jesus Christ is the fulfillment of the law. And I'm, yeah.
How did it protect? A little bit confused there.
It protected us until we could be made right with God through faith. Anybody want to try to answer that? Mark's asking in verse 24, how did the law protect us until we could be made right with God? Tim?
Speaking as normal Christian Tim, maybe that, maybe at that time, that was the only way to get justification, to gain righteousness, was attempting to follow this incredibly hard set of laws. And so without that, there was no way to justify ourselves before God, maybe.
Yeah, I think that's good. Online?
Mine is not online. This is Phil.
Oh, okay.
Online guy. I'm disagreeing a little bit because the like what Stephen said, Mr. Heppy, when you look at what the law does for us, or has done for us, it was the factor that led the Israelites out of Egypt into civil society.
Yes.
So they were slaves. Why were they slaves? Because of their disobedience and evil. And so God set up a pattern for them to follow that allowed them to live freely in independence. I would say the reason we have the civil society we do today is because we in the West have also followed those same guidelines. So you got to be careful, I think, when you say we did away with the law. Yeah, one fashion we did, because the law of love is greater than the law of sin and death. But on the flip side of it, this country functions because of the law, and we're not under an oppressive dictator because we obey the law. As soon as we give up that law, then we will have to be in the same situation as the Jews were in Egypt. We will have to be enslaved. And if you look at this world today, most of the nations are in slavery because they have not learned to obey the law. That's what makes the liberty of America liberty. But our law does go further in the sense that it is the law of love, which is greater than the law of sin and death.
I'll add you to the name of people that are going to complete the talk for me. Excellent, excellent, excellent. I agree. And what I'm trying to do here, and I'm only going to have time this morning to deconstruct this, to get us down to zero. No laws, no Mosaic laws apply to us as Christians. In 2 weeks, we're going to build it back up. And we're going to say what does apply to us, why it applies, and what we have to do with it, which is one thing Steve Huffy was talking about. I've got like 2 minutes left, so I need to kind of wrap this up, so let's do it in a couple weeks. One more verse that talks about this, Romans 3:20, for no one can ever be made right with God by doing what the law commands. Okay? Even the moral law. The law simply shows us how sinful we are. But now God has shown us a way to be made right with him without keeping the requirements of the law, as was promised in the writings of Moses and the prophets long ago. We are made right with God by placing our faith in Jesus Christ. And this is true for everyone who believes, no matter who we are. Where does that leave us then? As Christians, what guides our behavior?
Pride.
Are we completely free to do anything we want?
No.
Obviously not. There were 613 laws, commandments in the Old Testament that guided the Israelites' behavior and still guides the Orthodox Jewish community today, right? How many commands are there in the New Testament? Anybody want to guess?
One.
At least two.
Two.
Two?
There's
one, the law of Christ.
The law of Christ.
There's one if you say there's the law of Christ. If you actually go through and list out every time Paul says, let there be, or do this, or do that, there's actually more than there is in the Old Testament. 1,050. I got them all here. Anybody want, and these one I can probably print up in 2 weeks, but if anybody wants to look at these and memorize them, they're all there. But here's the distinction, and this is what I'm going to send you away with, and we'll pick it up again. Think about what the Old Testament laws were. Mostly, I'm not saying all, mostly, they were about what we did or didn't do and what we said or didn't say. They were on the surface. They were superficial things in the sense that your heart did not have to follow them. God said, do this and don't do that. Say this, don't say that. Sacrifice this, don't sacrifice that. It was external. Okay. We'll close with two verses. These two verses foretell in the Old Testament what's coming. Okay? One of these is one of my favorite verses in the whole Bible because I know my heart is a stony heart. The Bible.
I mean, what book is the
Bible? I'm getting there, Steve. New Covenant, Jeremiah 31, 33. But this is the new covenant I will make with the people of Israel on that day. I will put my instructions deep within them, and I will write them on their hearts. I will be their God, and they will be my people. So what's coming is, and we are in the process of getting there as Christians, our heart is changing. It's no longer about just what we do on a surface level or what we say without our heart being different. Okay, one more. Ezekiel 36, 26. And I will give you a new heart, and I will put a new spirit in you. Wow. I will take out your stony, stubborn heart and give you a tender, responsive heart. And I will put my spirit in you so that you will follow my decrees and be careful to obey my regulations. So here it is. The commands are still there, but the reason we do it is different. And how we do it. This is like in the top 10 of my personal favorite verses because I know what my heart feels like when it's stony and hard, when I get angry, when I lose touch with God, when I'm not thinking about him, and I go a while and I'm just on, you know, Ross control, okay? I know how that feels. And when I stop and slow down and pray and invite the Lord in and a little bit of that tenderness and softness comes in, it is the most amazing, wonderful thing that can happen. So this verse is really personal to me. I'll stop with this. If there's one word that can sum up the difference between the spirit of the Old Testament law and the spirit of the new law that Jesus gives us in the New Testament, It's the word love. And that's where we're going to end it. We'll pick it up there in 2 weeks. Thank you, everybody. Thank you, Tim. Thank you, Jeff.